This week, we talked to returning guest Brother Gerald Fortune about a multitude of topics, including the Egyptian negative confirmations. What do they do?
Once that law is submitted into the subconscious, what happens is the minute you imagine or picture a negative outcome, the law supersedes it.
Then, we talk about America and its future. Is America facing a spiritual war?
The masses think they're happening at some point in the near future, but they've already started.
And what exactly was the result of deifying George Washington, our nation's first president?
When they raised, apostatized him, or made him a god, he became the living spirit of this nation.
All this and more. Stay tuned for this exciting episode of Whence Came You.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back to the show. This is episode number 482. First things first, I want to thank all of our contributors, our fellows, our producers, and our legacy partners. Without you, we cannot produce this program. A couple of things that are in the news this week. First things first, I want to thank everyone who has been working with us on MasonicInstruction.com. What is MasonicInstruction.com? If you're a lodge out there and you're looking to get education, there's really not a better way to find a Masonic speaker that'll come to your lodge, either in person or Zoom, and a way to connect with them direct. So what this is, you go there, you can scroll through a list of speakers, click on their name, it opens up, gives you their biography, gives you their prepared talks, any travel arrangements they might need, their websites, and a contact form that when you fill it out, it goes directly to them. I'm not even in the mix. It's just a service I put together to help lodges get somebody. I'm working on adding a search function as well to the website. So that will be really great. You'll be able to search via certain keywords. So when you click on them, so you can see the talks that will be related to your search terms. Secondly, I want to thank everybody out there who has been buying and leaving reviews for the How to Charter a Lodge book. This was a book that was really on my mind for a long time. And I want to thank all of my contributors that came together to really give this book more context and more value. So you can pick up How to Charter a Lodge, a no-nonsense, unsanctioned guide on WCYpodcast.com, or if you'd like to get it through Amazon or Kindle, it's there also. I do have plans to release that book on Audible at some point, but we do have to get through a few other things first. The next thing that I would mention is, holy cow, did you guys catch this whole thing that happened over in South Carolina? Just a pretty wild circumstance of what had been going on over there. Now, I know every jurisdiction is really an island unto itself, but the Conference of Grand Masters is, I believe, just concluding. So I don't know how they're going to allow South Carolina Grand Master to attend if they're not allowed to get on virtual meetings at all. Also in the news, I had the great pleasure and honor of working with John Ruark again for a second time on a really great project. What was that project? It was to annotate, reformat, and give additional context and content for a classic work from 1913 called The Master's Word. Now, The Master's Word is titled A Short Treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self. It's a gem from the early 20th century, again, cherished by those who know it. Initially, it was published in 1913. The concepts are still very much discussed in countless philosophic and esoteric circles. So John and I really have set a standard in this particular literature to really clean it up. The book has been completely reformatted. We footnoted, adding context where it matters, meaning where antiquated words are used, and offering two completely new essays in the form of a prologue and an epilogue. And the new printing is really a must-have for fans of George Plumer's original work and the Masonic and Rosicrucian students alike. I was really excited. We gave an advanced copy out to Jamie Paul Lamb, author of Myth, Magic, Masonry, and Approaching the Middle Chamber, and he says, Johnson and Rourke do a tremendous job in their insightful curation of this largely forgotten volume by George Plumer, who is more widely known for his later, strictly Rosicrucian output. Throughout the work, Plumer takes a mystical perspective on science and philosophy from the priests of ancient Mizraim to the New Thought movement in his own era. Thanks to Johnson and Rourke for resurrecting this old gem, Jamie Paul Lamb. And I want to thank Jamie for those words. You know, when he says, resurrecting this old gem, all I can think of is this idea of biblionecromancy, raising the dead. But in any case, if that interests you, that also is out on Amazon right now and on Kindle right now. If you'd like an autographed copy, you can certainly order it from the WCY Podcast website. It will be a few minutes before I can get it to you just because author copies take longer to get than straight Amazon customer copies. So if you order it today, you'll get your copy of it before I get my copy of it, which is kind of weird, but hey, small price to pay for getting this great work out. And really the idea of keeping it alive. Now I know you heard in the top of the show, you're like, hey, wait a second. You said you were going to read more ancient and modern initiation this week. I know. I'm really sorry, but my good friend Gerald called and he said he wanted to do an episode, and we have to do an episode when Gerald calls because when he has something to say, you're going to want to listen. So I hope you enjoy this great talk I had with Brother Gerald Fortune. Let's check it out. Okay, everybody, I am really excited to have once again a returning guest, Brother Gerald Fortune. He appeared on episode number 451, I don't know, whatever it is, 30 episodes ago, one of our more popular episodes, The Magic in Egypt. Now, Brother Gerald Fortune has traveled the world in search of all things spiritual, esoteric, and looking for knowledge. Really intelligent gentleman, and I received nothing but amazing comments on our YouTube videos and people sending emails, hey, get Gerald Fortune back on. And it just so happened the stars aligned. Gerald and I were talking just a week and a half ago, maybe a week ago, and one thing that we were revolving our conversation around was this idea about America and being this great experiment, something was really special and even perhaps spiritual. And the first thing I want to do is open this conversation by asking Brother Gerald, just quickly, for people who didn't hear the last time you were on, what lodge are you from and any little background information we might want to add for context here?
Hello, everybody. I'm from A.O. Fay Lodge 676 in Highland Park and my home lodge of Palatine 314 here in Palatine, Illinois, where I'm at. And I'm still studying to get my master's in creative writing, but I am working on a project for Netflix. So I do have my first big project ahead of me. And writing has been a good distraction from everything that's going on in culture right now. So I'm in a great place, man. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, you know, I connected with you back a couple of years back when you presented for the Illinois Lodge of Research. Your story really resonated with me. I found it amazing. And anybody who wants to hear about that, episode 451 is where it's at. I want to really talk about in this episode something, again, that we were talking about last week. And that is, in the last few years, we've really seen some extraordinary division amongst the citizens of the United States. And we've even seen it with our brothers in the fraternity. And I think just off the bat, I'd love to get your perspective on this, Brother Gerald.
I like the way you started out when you said, the American experiment. And the reason why I like that, because we still don't know how this is going to turn out. We're only making a lot of assumptions. But in order for our government and our nation to move healthy into the future as the superpower that it was intended by our forefathers, and also our fraternity brothers started this nation. And so in order to move it in a direction that it's supposed to, Freemasons have to start exploring more of the mysteries that we've gotten away from. I think the most significant event that in the near future, they're going to look back and say one of the most significant events in our lifetime was Canada declaring the the Proud Boys as a terrorist organization. I think this is a huge deal. The fact that we have such a benevolent neighbor declaring them a terrorist organization, this opens a doorway for the rest of the world to judge how America is going to handle this problem. And unfortunately, this is a spiritual war. And people were thinking World War III is going to be more like World War II or World War I, but it's actually a spiritual war that as Freemasons, we're more equipped to win than anybody else in members of any society.
So when you say Freemasons are more equipped to kind of deal with this, when we initially talked, the title of the meeting that I put on our calendars was Masonry, Spiritual Healer of Nations. And this was just based on our initial conversations. As we've gone through, I mean, a lot of Masons, I would suppose, that have a philosophical or esoteric base to their interest in the fraternity, more so than, you know, whatever social club or those kinds of things. But when we think about these philosophical or spiritual esoteric minded brothers moving through Freemasonry in a series of degrees that teach certain truths that kind of build on each other, I guess I'm wondering, how can Freemasonry help is the first part of the question. And the second part of the question is, we've started to see something happen within the fraternity that makes me feel like, can we still do it?
I absolutely believe we can still do it. I know we can still do it. And the thing is, once we actually start doing it, it's fun. And the basis or the fundamental change that we all have to start making is self-observation. It's that, you know, it's that simple, and it's that hard. The more, even if you think about the double split experiment, you have to always, whenever you talk about true spirituality, you can lay science right next to it and it will fact check out as truth. Or you can lay math next to it and it'll fact check out as truth. So when you think about the double split experiment, I won't go all the way in it, but at the basis of it, it's saying if once you observe the particle, it behaves different. Now, take that and you overlay it on spirituality. Once we start observing ourselves, something begins to observe us. You see what I mean? And so once each Mason begins to focus on self-observation and ego work specifically, but not, you know, entirely, but mostly ego work, by us having experience in that third degree, we have a greater ability to affect our environment and the world. Because, I mean, you know, we've all heard the cliche, one person can change the world. Every time we heal something in ourselves, we heal that same thing in everybody else. You see what I mean? And we are weapons in that war. That's why we were raised off the floor. That's why a group of men raised each of us off the floor and awakened that spirit, the dormant soul, or Hiram Abiff or Osiris, etc. But now in each Mason, Master Mason, I should say, that spirit is awakened, but he still has to be taught before he goes back to the lodges of the Saints John. And once we weaponize him, it changes the societies, the neighborhoods, and everything that we interact with. That's how we have the ability to affect the outcome of our nation.
I've never quite heard it put in such a way. I mean, I think, you know, the way I've always thought about Freemasonry is, as a man and a Mason, I have been taken through the degrees. I've been taught the things I've been taught, and it's up to me to go out into the world and to change it based on how I represent myself. You know, that was my first kind of inclination. And as I progressed in Masonry, not necessarily in degrees, because I had already been a third degree, but as I progressed in Masonry in terms of learning, thinking, reading, and then you learn about this concept of introspection, this concept of working on egos, this concept of thinking about how you've acted. And I mean, ultimately, you know, you think about the judge, right, with the scales of justice, and you think about how you can apply that, you know, to your own ego. And I mean, it's like the trial of Mot, right? The Egyptian trial. I think when we're doing the proper ego work and we're changing the way we are, I've never really thought about us as weapons, because weapon, the word, has such a negative connotation. But in this sense, it's like a weaponized spiritual warrior, right? Like, you're going out into the world, you're giving good in the hopes that that good is received, and changing the way other people act because they've seen somebody else exhibit those same things. I suppose the kind of, I don't want to say cliche, but I suppose kind of the cliche thing is people say, you'll know a Mason by the way he acts. And maybe that was true 100 years ago, but I don't see that every day today. And maybe it's just because the public in general doesn't know what a Mason is or whatever, because had a decline in membership or public relations or whatever you want to say. Damn, Gerald, I love physics. And when you brought up the double slit experiment, I really wasn't sure where you were going until you said the observer. The observer is necessary to manifest all things, material, reality, destiny. It's an incredible story. Anybody who's curious about the double slit experiment, as Gerald has said, by witnessing what the particle does, by watching it, it changes it. And it begs the question, you know, anybody who wants to say, you know, there's no deity or there's no higher force or higher power, no creator, no intelligent design, you have to wonder, that goes back to that physics question, right? Who observed the Big Bang? These kind of questions.
Right.
Big questions. But how can Freemasonry help, Gerald? I mean, can you talk a little bit about what we're actually enabled to do and how to act? I mean, are we supposed to, like, go full political, or are we supposed to just be good people? What are you thinking?
Well, we're not supposed to go full political. Exoterically, we are, if we follow the charges that we take as Master Masons, that's like a huge step in the right direction. And you made two amazing segues. The first was when you tied the double split experiment over to magic with the K, or occultic rituals by the observer, because by tying it completely over to magic the way you just did, now what you have is you almost a scientific fact of there being a creator, depending on how you want to look at it, because once you observe that atom and it begins to behave differently, that's the purpose of all spiritual literature, so that depending on where a person's consciousness is, even if all they have is that creator in the Bible or the Torah or the Bhagavad Gita or the Quran, now they are imagining themselves being observed by a creator, and it changes their behavior. Now, when you get into Master Masons and adepts at the occult and magic, we have a much more direct relationship with the spiritual world. So children or men that are not as into the mystical as, you know, most Master Masons may be, they at least have those guidebooks of Bible and Tarot and Quran so that they can imagine that they're being observed. Another great segue you made was when you tied it over to the judge, the Hall of Mot, because that's exactly where I wanted to go with this. The thing is, when you ask what can we do as Masons, I took a trip over to Egypt this, I don't know if I got a chance to tell you, but just this past October, because I wanted to go and watch the Return of the King festival. So I took the Nile down to Abu Simbel after stopping in Karnak but what I wanted was to be able to find and interpret those 11 laws of Mot from the temples for myself. and I was able to do it. Well, if you take the Kabbalistic tree of life, this is a symbol that goes back even further to Egypt. You can find it in the on the ceiling of Dendera. It's actually a planetary schematic. If you start at the first Sephiroth, then you go over to 2, which would be Chokhmah. This would be our fixed star system. Then you go over to 3, which would be Bina. This would be Saturn. And then you go down to 4. This would be Jupiter. And over to Mars. And then in the middle, you have the Sun, Mercury, and Venus to the right and left. And then the Moon and the planet down Malkuth. Now, if you take that same schematic back to ancient Egypt, each Sephiroth represented an archetype or a Necheru, which is a composite of the human conscious system. And there's a law that governs each Sephiroth in ancient Egypt, and these are the laws of Mot. And it's where Judaism also gets their Ten Commandments. It's originally, it's what it's called is the Negative Confessions. And I think there's actually hundreds of them, but the first 11 is based on that Tree of Life schematic. Now, at the past winter solstice, what I do every winter solstice is I resubmit these laws into the subconscious, because now what happens is you awaken those different consciousnesses within you. Once all of those consciousnesses are awakened within the man, in the ancient Egyptian spirituality, he becomes the Asur or Osiris. All those consciousnesses need to be awakened for the Asur consciousness to now be awakened. Now, if you're Christian, that's your Christ consciousness, of course. But each Sephiroth has a law. So, for example, the very first one, which would be Ein Sof or Keter, that would be Amen, the law of Amen. So the negative confession for that would be, not have I violated the law of Amen. I do not speak hate, anger, jealousy, grief, worry, or fear, or any of its kind. Number 2 would be the law of Asur. All challenging events in my life are for my peace and joy. I have no enemies. The next would be the law of Tehuti. Not have I violated the law of Tehuti. I seek to help all those I conquer and defeat. Not have I violated the law of Mot. It is my destiny to become the vehicle for God. I desire peace, law, order, reciprocity for all men. All that I do for man is for the majesty of God. Not have I violated the law of Herakuti or Mars. Only God can correct the spiritual mistakes of man. I do not wish them an ill path to suffer, but a path to Amen. Not have I violated the law of Heru. It is my will, and that's Heru is the sun or Zeus, and that is, it holds the concept of free will, and because it is our divine self. The negative confession that corresponds to it is, not have I violated the law of Heru. It is my will to respond to all thoughts, challenges, emotions, and sensations according to divine law. All challenges are met with and balanced by divine law. Now, the reason why this is like one of my favorite laws is because once these laws, all 11 laws, are incorporated into the subconscious, what begins to happen is, you ever see in the movies like where Neo and the Terminator, they get this visual effect according to every situation that they go into? That's exactly what the laws do for you. In every situation, it begins to balance you out with natural law in any situation that comes into your sphere of influence. So you are at peace in all challenges that come at you. You are able to extract whatever lessons that the creator or nature is trying to impose on you in order to change you or transform you back into correspondence with the first law of thermodynamics, where energy is, it cannot be made or destroyed. It can only be transferred or transformed, as opposed to the second law of thermodynamics, which is energy that is slipping into entropy. Now, if you are not actively on a conscious level trying to transform yourself or the space that is your energy, what happens is you are automatically governed by the second law of thermodynamics, which then pulls you into decline. And that's what we're seeing happen with our country, our fellow citizens, and in some cases, unfortunately, with our fraternal brothers. If we are not actively seeking to transform ourselves, then we are being forced into entropy or into decline, because now we've entered that time in our existence where it is those end days where we are all being judged. Everyone is being held account, whether we know it or not. You know, a lot of spiritualities or religions think that there is some other plane that we go to be judged, or there's some other hell or physicality or lack of that these things happen after the death process. But according to the temples, we are in the death process now. That's why the minute you are born, you begin to die. This is the death process. The Reaper is always behind us from the time we're born to the minute we die. He walks with us. That's because we're in a state of, we are slipping into a state of entropy at all times. Only when a man goes through that third ritual does he stave off that Grim Reaper, because now he has tapped into that sixth law, that law of Heru, and he's activated his free will.
One of the things I think I want to touch on here is you talk about, you know, the second law and the danger, right? So second law of thermodynamics, I mean, if you guys are unaware, I mean, it has very practical resources and has been somewhat attributed to the advent of, not the advent of, but the refortification of a lot of New Age concepts that back up age-old philosophies and religious ideas that have been around for thousands of years. This same set of laws, scientific principles, are the reason why you have a refrigerator and why it works. Science, right? We know this works. And one of the ideas that you talked about, this second law, we talks about chaos. Chaos increasingly develops within the closed system. And so if I'm reading you right, if I'm imagineering what you're saying here, is that if we're choosing not to, like, walk a path, then we are essentially a part of the expanding chaos in the system. Is that fair to say?
That's pretty much it. That's what happens. You have to make that active choice. You have to activate that free will in order to move outside of chaos. Otherwise, you are just being led by it. You know, if you can think about our universe as that fixed system, you see? So,
and it really is a closed system, because as much as I want to love the idea of, I'll geek out at science and physics here for a minute, but as much as I love the idea of traversing universes, we've got the scientific proof that shows if you were going to take an unimaginable step backward and look objectively at our universe, and then if you were able to step out of our universe to see what was there, you could imagine a string and droplets of water on the string. Each droplet within is a universe. And so when we look at our scientific kind of radiation maps of the universe, we notice what looks like graphic representations look like these dark spots. And they say, what are these dark spots? Well, they say those dark spots are actually cold spots. And they're cold because gravity from the universe next door is pulling on them. And then that pull is just like the law, it's the second law of thermodynamics. To have cold, you have to pull the heat out. That's how this works. So we know there's a secondary universe around us. There are many, and we can never actually get out into the next one over. Well, science has no way to explain how we would jump over. So for all intents and purposes, this is the closed system. I would love to pick your brain a little bit about, for so many brothers out there today listening to this who have been active on social media, and we won't get political here, but what I do want to ask is, when we see brothers who pick a side and are so deeply entrenched to cause or be a part of chaos, what do you think the first step for a brother? I mean, obviously you have to be ready to make that step, to be a little bit introspective, to say, okay, I need to fix this. How can I fix this? What's the first step, do you think, for those brothers?
That's a great question. I think the first step for those brothers is to remember something very fundamental to our fraternity, and that is to learn to subdue my passions and improve myself in masonry. So a lot of times we don't remember just how all-encompassing those passions may be, and we never get into specifics about what those passions may be, because there's a positive and there's a negative connotation to the word, but there's also a positive and a negative connotation to every single statement that someone makes, and you're going to receive that statement based on your vibration and space. If you think that that brother means something negative towards you, or he means something positive towards you. If we start, like, at the very first step is to remember to learn to subdue my passions because and improve myself in Freemasonry. If a brother is serious about that right there, because that's what's going to bring us closer to the Creator. It's a separate conversation, but do we truly believe in there being a Creator, or do we know that there's a Creator? Because as Master Masons, we have the ability to know that there's a Creator. We don't have to have a belief in it. You don't need to have a belief in a scientific certainty or fact, because it can be proven. And by subduing those passions, it allows each Mason a better look at himself, because that's the only way to subdue your passions. Those things that pull you away from your center, those things that pull you into the negative ego space.
I think it does start with this idea of subduing the passion. And in my mind, I keep thinking about taking that step back to look at all things a little bit more objectively. You know, my ma used to say, walk a mile in somebody's shoes. And what that makes me do is think about something outside of the way I normally would perceive something, you know, similar that we would do in maybe the work of the tarot or something along those lines, right? Each card might be specific to you, dependent on the situation you're in. It's a self-reflective act. And so, you know, how would I perceive my own existence through somebody else's life experiences, and then shape my opinion of that person, and through the adversity that person has had or experienced, and then realizing that I have not had that, it puts the world in a much different context when we choose to A, subdue the passion, B, to truly seek not a middle ground, because that, you know, this is more about, you know, trying to manage something on the physical plane, I guess. You know, in this mental or spiritual state, this allows us to, I mean, it sounds silly, but to come together as Masons, you know, the verbiage is who best can work and best agree. It's kind of strange the way that the Masonic wording is in front of us the whole time. Can I ask, you listed 6 of these laws so far, and I'm curious if we can hear the others also.
Oh, yeah, I would love to finish those laws. The rest of them are the inner planets, and so they become real interesting. The next one after Heru would be the law of Het Heru, or Venus. Not have I violated the law of Het Heru. I can only envision the positive outcome to any challenges to me. My imagination can only realize divine law. There are no negative outcomes for me. Now, remember also on, you know, on an occultic level, Venus represents the imagination. Venus represents our ability to manifest. So when you think about there being a law, a natural law that says, not have I violated the law of Het Heru, I can only imagine the positive outcome to any challenge to me. So anytime we enter into a situation and we are imagining that something negative is going to happen to us or as a result of our laudable endeavors, we're violating natural law. We're never supposed to imagine that we can fail at anything. That is governed by Venus. The next one, and that's based on the pictures that we draw in our mind.
I got to stop you just because this is so fascinating to me, because this idea of Het Heru is, this is what the late 19th century, early 20th century spiritualism really started to come out of the woodwork when guys like Carnegie talked about the law of attraction and what later becomes almost the secret, like this idea of affirmation, of imagining doing the good stuff and staying away from the negative thoughts. Everybody says, you know, misery loves company. Or, you know, these kinds of things. Your perception drives the reality you exist in, right? I mean, this is this is so old, timeless logic.
Yeah. It's so simplistic on the surface of it, but the importance of it can't be overstated. And the next law is actually Sebek or Mercury. Not have I violated the law of Sebek. My logic will empower the reason for positive effects to any challenges to me. My rational convictions are victorious. There are no negative outcomes for me. Now, the reason why these are brother and sister laws is because Sebek governs your logic or your logistical or verbal mind, the reasons that we think we are going to pass or fail or succeed at whatever endeavor. Het Heru governs your visual or your imagination, the pictures that you see in your mind's eye of your success or your failure. And back to Sebek is the words that you tell yourself, the logic on why you will succeed or fail. I'm going to fail because my father was a failure, or I'm going to succeed because there are no negative outcomes for me and I have done my due diligence and hard work at understanding what my craft is, so therefore I will not fail. And so those two, imagination and logic, work hand in hand. The next one is the law of Aset, or the moon, which governs our emotions. Not have I violated the law of Aset. Peace, joy, and happiness are my endeavors. There are no negative outcomes for me. And the last one is Geb or Malkuth, or the actual planet that binds us here in time. Not have I violated the law of Geb. My challenges on the physical plane are for the mastery of circumstance. No past performance or limitation can govern my reality, for I live according to divine principles. There are no negative outcomes for me. If you go back through them, each law has a correspondence to another law. And as a whole, they represent that schematic of the Kabbalistic tree of life, or these are the laws, the negative confessions that we have to stand before Mot in the judgment hall. If you can imagine, I know you've heard of, you know, the Egyptian Book of the Dead or the Pert M. Heru, which is what the ancient Egyptians called it. One of the fundamental differences in the way they saw reality and the way we see reality is this is life to us, and then we go on to another place after we die. Well, in the ancient spirituality, life was that other place when you were born from your mother, you actually died to come into this reality to be judged. And these are the laws that you have to live by, according to their ancient culture.
Fascinating that we would move from one plane of existence into the one we're in. And this is such a topsy-turvy type idea. We see this all the time when we look at old science papers or old religious or philosophical papers or doctrines that automatically assume that nobody will understand this better than we do today. And rather, we've kind of flipped the script here. We always want to say that we're important. We must be the top of the chain. We must be this. We must be that. We are the best. We're the top species. And yet here, some of this remains true, but the idea is that no. This reality is not the penultimate piece of existence. In fact, this is the lower end of the spectrum, and you died to come here, which is really fascinating to me. Going back to these negative confessions, one thing that I found fascinating was they all ended with this affirmation. I can see how this particular set of laws or negative confessions, when memorized and used as affirmation, will change the way you live your life. There's so much to me, maybe it's just because it's mystical or something, but it speaks to me more than most other commandments or systems. It's really fascinating. So I want to thank you for bringing that to my attention specifically. I'm sure our listeners are fascinated by it as well. So what's the next step, Gerald? What do we do next?
Well, as far as the laws are concerned, what I've done particularly, and this will be my eighth year going through these cycles of elevating consciousness according to the ancient Egyptian principles of spirituality. And so what happens is they had a correspondence that overlaid our lodges of the Saints John's, which are represented by the solstices, the winter solstice and the summer solstice. Now, we all know what it means, whence came you, from the lodges of the Saints John's of Jerusalem. What came you here to do? To learn to subdue my passions and improve myself in masonry. Now, those two lodges, or the summer solstice and the winter solstice, is when you have direct access to the Creator and to your subconscious. Those two moments on the calendar, if you look at time in a cyclical way, you know, you have the circle of the hour, the 24 hours of the day, and then you have the year. Imagine we're not moving forward in time, but we're moving in a circle fashion. So what happens is at that high point of high noon and the low point of midnight, on a larger scale, is represented by the two lodges or the solstice. So high noon, which is the junior warden, that's also the summer solstice marker. So at those points, what I do is I have all the negative confessions and the corresponding laws. I have them committed to long-term memory. Now, once you get something committed to long-term memory, what you want to do is you want to do your breathing process and your meditation processes. So what happens is through the correct breathing patterns, and of course anybody can induce a trance. It's just the correct breathing pattern. And, you know, I hear a lot of people say, well, how do I, you know, clear my mind in order to reach a trance state or a meditative state? You're not trying to clear your mind. You're just going to let your mind clear itself as the thoughts, whatever random thoughts come into your sphere of influence. You don't want to attach your consciousness to them. Don't try to fight them off, or don't try to clear your mind or stop thinking about anything, because now you're thinking about not thinking. You just watch the thoughts come, or listen to the thoughts come into your sphere of influence. And once you train yourself to stop attaching yourself to any one of these given thoughts and chasing it down the rabbit hole, I've got to take the car to get an oil change tomorrow at 12. Just let it go. Don't attach it to whatever you have to do that comes along with that. And the next thing you know, you're thinking about, you know, a run to McDonald's because you've chased these thoughts down this rabbit hole. What you want to do is just sit there, let the thoughts pass in and out of your sphere of influence and focus on your breath. You will actually feel your body and your mind switch over into the trance state. Once you are in that trance state, you want to recite those laws into the subconscious. Because once those laws are recited into your subconscious from long-term memory, now what happens is they dictate your behavior according to the laws. Because every single time you imagine a negative outcome to something that you're trying to do, or how picturing how many ways you're going to fail at this one thing you don't want to fail at, but it's almost a reflex to think of our failures or think of disaster, because on that mental level, we are obeying that second law of thermodynamics and we're declining into entropy. Now, what happens? So therefore, we automatically think of all the negative outcomes to anything we're going to do. And we, you know, eventually push forward and we succeed or fail, whatever. But once that law is submitted into the subconscious, what happens is the minute you imagine or picture a negative outcome, the law supersedes it. It reminds you at that very moment to not imagine a negative outcome. There are no failures once that law is in place. Everything now is seen as lessons to get to that ultimate goal, whatever it may be. There are no negative outcomes for me. What I do now is once those laws are in my subconscious, it dictates all my movements, my relationships, everything that I say in a given situation, how I carry myself in social situations and staying on schedule and things of that nature. The laws will dictate those behaviors for you. Now, once that happens, every Mason is that has done this, he's weaponized. You know, he's literally in battle in that spiritual war that we actually can't see that's going on, where the energy is fighting one another, trying to make the energetic changes from one age to another. You know, as we move from the previous age into the next age, those energies, there's a battle that takes place between those energies that we can't see, but it's being played out through us and we're just completely unaware of it.
When I hear about this battle that's going on, I start thinking about, I grew up Roman Catholic, not particularly, I'm not a Roman Catholic anymore. Just through my own spiritual growth or whatever, I've gravitated towards something else. But growing up Roman Catholic, the first thing, I've got this, the foundation stone of this kind of philosophy is like end of times, the Battle of Megiddo, the holy books. All these holy books have end time scenarios that's going on. It's always in my head because we're taught that these are literalisms. This is a real flesh blood battle that's happening. And then we talk about maybe like you look at a group like Seventh Day Adventism in the early 20th century who believe that at any given point, Armageddon is going to happen. We are indeed living right now as we speak in the end of times. Be ready to go like now in the next 5 minutes. And you have to live that way all the time. And my question is, when we're talking about things like the spiritual battle, is there a correspondence, a correlation between these ideas, or am I off base?
You're right on target every single time. That's exactly what's happening. So these end time wars or Armageddon, the battle at Megiddo, those holy books, the Bible, the Quran, all of them are, they're great books because they have the ability, they're actually all divine books. I shouldn't say, you know, great books. The men that wrote those books were able to tap into divinity and to be able to write those books. Now, we can judge the books and say we don't like the book or whatever. That's because you receive that book at the level of consciousness that you're emitting or that you or your frequency is at. That's the book that you're going to actually read. So there is within the Bible, there is everyone is going to read that book and interpret it in a different way. You know, obviously there's thousands of people listening to, you know, one person telling them an interpretation of the book. But everybody can read these books and get a different interpretation because they are written to appeal to at every single level of consciousness because they're all like the tarot card system. So if you think about the lover's card, that is simply, that's the picture version of the story of Adam and Eve. The Tower of Babel, that's the tower card. If you think about the strength card, that was in some cases, depending on the tarot card system, it's actually the Whore of Babylon. But, you know, some cards are a little bit, you know, more benevolent with it. That's why I like Aleister Crowley's Tarot Thoth deck, because he's brutally honest with it. He wrote his in a biblical way because they are both taken from ancient Egypt, Egyptian hieroglyphic systems. And so he's actually, in my opinion, he's the most honest with his tarot card system. But back to your point, I didn't mean to veer off, but those wars are already taking place right now. The masses think they're happening at some point in the near future, but they've already started years ago. And that's why everything is slipping into decline. I mean, think about the fact that we, for whatever reasons, we just had a group of people storm the Capitol Rotunda right under George Washington's apotheosis. If you right there in that rotunda where George Washington's apotheosis is painted, we've had rioters running straight through that rotunda. If that's not proof of the second law of thermodynamics, I don't know what is. Like, I mean, I never even imagined that something like that would happen in anybody's lifetime, let alone my lifetime. But more importantly, the world is watching that happen. Those images just went out all over the world to see somebody storming the Capitol. It doesn't matter if it's inside the citizens. We look at citizens in countries all around the world storming their buildings, and it's just a matter of time before other citizens of the world decide they need to get involved. Now, I'm not saying at all that that's where this is going, but it certainly does make us look vulnerable.
Well, it's interesting that you mention it, right? Because to bring it back to almost full circle here is the observer. It's turned all of the world into an observer, which then sees a situation that is a negative thing, right? Which is the opposite of like these negative confessions where we're having a positive affirmation at the end of telling somebody or reaffirming to the consciousness that we are not going to act in this negative manner. And yet here we are reaffirming or solidifying a reality that could be if, you know, if we're not careful, if we don't take the next step, if we don't exhibit.
Yeah, we're on the same page here, you know, and yeah, you're right. It goes back full circle. Even you can incorporate the double split experiment again, because now we're being observed. And the only way to eradicate the problem is for us to start observing ourselves or for us to start doing ego work. To me, the most amazing part of it is, you know, we glaze over the rituals that the founding fathers had to use to start this country and to build this nation. And what was this all about? Why did Brother George Washington do the rituals he did in D.C.? Why is there a 555-foot Egyptian obelisk as his memorial? Like, what does any of this mean? Like, you know, and that's really important to explore, because if you think about it in terms of them creating a nation, not just the way we see it at a one-dimensional perspective. This nation is a living, breathing organism with all these moving parts, and it's an organism. It's not just this big piece of land with all these people. It's an organism in the sense that it has a spirit, which is the entire point of George Washington's apotheosis, that when they apotheticized him or made him a god, he became the living spirit of this nation. But you also have to remember, in order to make something a living organism in both the physical and the spiritual world, that means this country also had not just have a spirit, it also has an ego. Our country has an ego as a whole because we all contribute to the ego of our country. And the only way to correct the ego of that country is for each of us individually to do ego work on ourselves. You see, because then we get the entire nation back in alignment with the spiritual principles that it was founded on. As Freemasons, we're living in a different country than the regular citizens are living in. But unfortunately, a lot of the brothers don't realize that. You know, this nation means something totally different to us than it means to the rest of the country. We have a spiritual and moral obligation towards our nation based on our relationship with each other, based on our subduing of our passions and doing our own ego work.
It feels like the answer to then, or maybe not the answer, but the first starting point here is for our brothers to start doing this ego work, right? But in a way that, if you're unsure, if this sounds a little too wild or a little too esoteric for you, I would then just ask those brothers out there listening, or even the profane who listen to this show, the uninitiated, to start thinking about who you are and how you can be better and act better and all of these things. It starts at like this really simple kind of level, and then you can start to build up. And maybe one day, who knows, maybe you're doing these negative confessions or something, but it feels like this is the first step to look inside at ourselves, understand who we are, and then I would say maybe, Gerald, is the answer to then go out into the world and be the person, or at least pretend to be the person you want to be, you know, this good person until it happens. Fake it till you make it.
You summed it all up. That's basically it. If you're not into these esoteric principles and occultic principles, just on a rudimentary level, what can you do to self-observe and better yourself as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a co-worker, as a brother?
Brother Gerald, this has been fascinating, and I really feel like there is hope for the future of, you know, humanity, because it feels like that's not all that what's at stake is not just this American experiment, almost 250 years old. It's the idea of goodness and the elevation of mind and spirit is what's on the line if we only realize so below as above, right? Instances of the hierarchy of quote unquote sizes, right? Whether from the molecule to the person to the planet, planet to the stars and beyond. Just like the observer watches the particle change its mind about what it's going to do, so do we change how we act when we imagine the observer watching us.
Yeah.
And that it's almost like we're forgetting we are watching each other as observers as well. And the outcome of this, if we're not careful, is going to be the increase or the descent into chaos, right? As you mentioned, I want to pass it back to you for final thoughts and anything else that you wanted to mention.
Oh, wow. Thanks for having me on. I love coming on your show, man. It's great. We really hash it out on here. What I was going to say is, I have copies of those because I went over the 11, the negative confessions. I also have the corresponding 11 laws. I can email those over to you if you get some viewers that want to go through them, or if they want us to go back over them again, or if you want to pick them apart and then we can do a show based on the laws and the negative confessions or whatever. I'll email those over to you.
I would absolutely love it. And I know the listeners would love it as well. So just fantastic, brother. Again, Gerald, I want to say thank you so much for carving out some time. I know when we talked, I said, when do you want to do a show? And he said, as soon as possible. And I knew right then you had a really special inclination to do something and to get this message out. And so I want to thank you for being persistent and, you know, getting me on the phone and doing this episode.
Thank you, bro. Thanks for having me. And anytime, man, you know, let's do it again.
Awesome.
Well, there is the interview with Brother Gerald Fortune. I hope you guys all enjoyed. I'll have links to everything that we talked about in the show notes. We're probably going to have Brother Gerald on again in the future to talk a little bit more in detail about some of these topics that he had contained within this interview. But we'll be back next week with Ancient and Modern Initiation, as well as some other great work. Once again, I want to thank our contributors, fellows, and producers, and of course, our legacy partners for making this all possible. Go get the Master's Word from the website. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.